let's appreciate we can do animals that actually heal the planet and don't hurt the planet. Same animal, 180 degree different kinds of things. We don't have time on this podcast to zero in on all those avenues. But be assured, anybody that's listening that thinks we need to get rid of animals to save the planet, nothing could be further from the truth.
The Biological Farming Roundtable podcast helps farmers explore innovative, low-input, regenerative, and profitable farming systems. The Biological Farming Roundtable is sponsored by Nutrisoil, an award-winning biological liquid fertilizer made from a big worm farm. Nutrisoil's purpose is to empower farmers to produce life-enriching food. My name is Nicola Maddock. I work at Nutrisoil. I envisage a future where farmers are rewarded for producing nutrient-rich foods and consumers have this easily available to them. Today's conversation is with Joel Salatin, a farmer, author, wordsmith, master communicator, and world-renowned spokesperson for regenerative agriculture. Co-hosting with me is Charlie Arnott, biodynamic, holistic cattle, sheep, and pig producer. This is the conversation we had the evening prior to the Nutrisoil Sustainable Abundance event. Two great men nutting out the complexities and marvels of life. We talk farming, politics, psychology, health, and carnivores. I invite you to sit back and be part of our conversation. Today I'm here with Charlie Arnott, co-hosting this podcast and interviewing Joel Salatin, an American farmer who is well known for multi-stacking his enterprises. Thanks for being on the show today, Joel.
Thank you. It's a delight to be with you.
Wonderful. Tell us a bit about your farm.
Well, we have a multi-species pasture livestock farm in Virginia in the U.S. We've been there since 1961. And we sell everything direct to restaurants and individuals. So we have beef, pork, chicken, turkey, eggs, duck eggs, lambs, lumber, and whatever else we can cobble together to pay the taxes.
Joel, I was at a function last week and you were speaking at, and you mentioned that one of the critical turning points in your life was when you were cut from the baseball team when you were in your teens, I think it was. Can you explain why that was such a turning point?
Yeah, well, for me, I grew up, my mom was a health and phys ed teacher in high school. I had an older brother who was a kind of an athlete standout. And, here you are, the second kid, coming on. And so I went out for the baseball team in the seventh grade and didn't make the team, got cut. Not for the eighth grade basketball team, got cut, didn't make it. I was a late bloomer, kind of a pudgy little middle schooler kind of kid. And but the reason that that's an important story is because I vowed I would never again go out for a ball team. And I had had some success in the spelling bees, poetry readings, speaking contests and things. And so I determined at that point to turn all my attention to communication arts, drama, theater, debate, forensics and all that, and did all that through high school and college. And looking back now, I'm so grateful for that failure. And I tell middle schoolers, be thankful for your failures because they help you to see where your gifts and talents and passions are that you can leverage in the future for things that you might have no clue what you'll be using, but it'll help you focus your attention on things where you're strong rather than where you're weak. So I encourage young people for that, and don't be depressed and frustrated about your failure. Figure it's part of the cosmic correction of your life to move you where you need to be.
Well, there's that that phrase, there's no growth stimulant like pain, is there? And also the growth occurs in the valleys, in the low points when we're sort of on a bit of a downer, and the tops of the hills, it doesn't really grow because you don't learn when you're up there.
Absolutely. It's the failure that makes the progress happen. The only difference between people that we call successful and people that we say are failures are not, the opposite of success is not failure. The opposite of success is quitting. And so people who are successful have failed as many times as people who aren't, except for the last time. And so I tell people, look, you know, we're not that smart. We were just too stubborn to quit. But those experimental failures in your life are, you know, are steering wheels, if you will, you know, for your own understanding of yourself and where your talents lie.
Like guideposts.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Like guideposts. And who would have guessed, you know, at that time that I would be the spokesman for Integrity Agriculture, you know, and travel the world and do this. And you know, it was funny when I went back to the farm full time, you know, all my college buddies and, you know, professors and things like that were lamenting that I was, oh, he's going to throw his life away. He's going back to the farm, you know, and, you know, all this talent's going to be wasted. And I probably talked to more people than anybody off of the debate team and the drama team at that time. In what I'm doing today. Mm-hmm. So it's a real joy to be able to have the farm, but to also then enjoy this communication skill and passion and kind of hone that skill as well.
How grateful we are that you're doing that for Regenerative Ag, Joel. I think that your voice is really helping others change and giving them the confidence to change this food system. So when did you go back to the farm?
So after college, in high school, I had worked part-time at the local newspaper and loved it. I'm still a news junkie. And so after college, the problem was that, you know, we were on the farm. The farm was not a going concern. Mom and dad was an accountant, mom was a school teacher, and they're off-farm jobs. You know, typical paid for the land. So here I come up as a teen. Finally, the land gets paid for. We're out of debt, but it's not a going concern. It's just a good place to grow up and learn about things and build forts and dams in the creeks and learn how to work and that sort of thing. Dad was a genius, way ahead of his time, and he understood the ecological approach to farming. But you know, working in town, paying the mortgage, we just didn't have it. So I'm done out. How am I going to make a living on this farm? How can I make a salary here? And so I went back to the newspaper and worked a couple of years as I sorted that out in my mind. And Teresa and I had gotten married by that time, and we actually saved up enough money that we could live for 1 year. And we lived in an attic in the farmhouse, drove a $50 car. If we didn't grow it, we didn't eat it. No TV. We still don't have a TV. We wore, you know, thrift store clothes, didn't go to town, didn't eat out, and we could live on about $300 a month. And so I said, you know what, we've saved up enough. We could live for a year on this savings, even if things kind of are slow on the farm. And by that time I knew, working at the newspaper, I did a lot of interviews with business people and stuff like that. And I knew that there's not a business person in the world that wouldn't give their right arm to have somebody who's dependable, honest, and hardworking, who doesn't complain about the job, who shows up on time, you know, that sort of thing. And so I said, you know what? I'm the most employable person in the world. And because I'm dependable, I don't mind hard work, and I even can think a little bit. And so that reality made me say, you know what, we've got this nest egg, we can go a year, and if it runs out and I have to go back to work, I can push concrete for a mason. I'm not scared to dig ditches, wash dishes, I don't care. So that's what we did. And of course, what happened was it didn't run out, you know, and we didn't have to go back off farm for work. It was tight, you know, it was real close, but by being there, we were able to reduce slippage. We were there for every calf that was born, every time the green beans needed weeded. You know, we were there for things, and slippage dropped off, and we were able to squeak by.
Joel, one of the things you also mentioned last week was the storytellers lead their trade, which is, you know, fascinating. What, can you tell us about that? Why is that the case?
Well, because the people who can explain and catch the emotion of their vocation, they're the ones that excite the imagination of people. And so storytelling, I mean, a sophisticated kind of storytelling is advertising, obviously, marketing, messaging, but the people who can articulate their vocation in an attractive way and sell their vocation, not just a product, but sell their vocation, their life. They lead the vocations because that's what the vocation wants. They want somebody who can articulate its attractiveness. And so, you know, when young parents come up and they've got a 9-10-year-old child, boy or girl, you know, they say, my Johnny or Mary, you know, they tell me they want to be a farmer. What should they do? And I say, go join the local theater group. You know, learn to communicate, learn to be comfortable in front of people and tell stories. Because if you can communicate, you know, you can learn the nuts and bolts of a lot of skills. But expressing those and explaining them in attractive ways is an art.
Real skill. Yeah.
It really is. Yeah.
I think it's exposing people to new possibilities. If we do the same thing day in and day out on our farm, how are we going to know that there's new ways to multi-stack, to change the land that we've probably degenerated, and we need to look at other ways outside of the box to do things? So that communication and that theatre ability to get it out there, it's essential in regenerative ag.
Yeah, which is why one reason why I promote, I don't know anybody else that writes farm books and has chapters titled, you know, read eclectically. I mean, you don't read farm books that admonish farmers to read eclectically. I mean, read fiction, read nonfiction, read history, read business, because this all adds to an interesting communicator is a person who has a broad breadth of understanding. And we farmers as a group, we farmers, I think, tend to, we read our trade journals, our trade publications, but we tend to not read, I think, widely enough.
I think, learning soil science, I can read a psychology book about how the brain works, and I can actually connect how a cell works in the brain to how a cell works in the soil. So it's connecting it all, because everything is interconnected. So if we look just at agriculture and we don't look at psychology, human health, the environment, everything, we're not going to grow.
Well, and the whole world political situation, where are things going? I mean, to appreciate what Uberization is doing in the marketplace, what Amazon's doing in the marketplace, the fact that my generation asked what's for dinner, and today's generation asks what's dinner. I mean, those are important socio-political trends and moves, mega trends, I think they're called. But those fascinate me, and I think that if you're a farmer in business, I always say, you know, nostalgia sells. It's nice, you know, nostalgia is nice as long as you leave it one day before you're obsolete.
And there's another expression. I'm full of expressions today, aren't I? It's about selling the sizzle, not just the sausage, isn't it?
That's right.
So there's the product, but then there's the story behind the product, and that's really what it's the smell of the sausage, you know, on a barbecue that actually gets people to get there. You know, that's just the same as the story, and every farmer has a story.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's there's a book out, Selling the Invisible, and it's all about that. You know, and that's one reason why we want people to come to the farm. We get about 15,000 visitors a year to the farm, and even though we're not we don't have camping, and we don't have, you know, we're not a farm of Disney by any means. We're a very much a working farm, but we know that when people come, they see it, they smell it, they touch it, they participate viscerally in it. It's magic. It's just magic. And then that creates buzz, and you get social posts, and you get all sorts of sizzle, as you said, sizzle, because you're actually trying to sell a memory. We've just put in this year, one of our big expansion projects this year is essentially putting in natural entertainment for kids. So we put in a big corn box. You can go anywhere and play in a sandbox, but you got to come to our farm and play in a corn box. It's just a great big box, like a sandbox, except it's corn. And it's not as dirty as sand, you know, doesn't get in your pockets as bad. And what kids ever played in a corn box, you know? And we've got all the Tonka toys and, you know, stuff you'd have on a beach in a sandbox, but it's corn. And it's just, you can't get them out of there, you know? And of course, the longer they stay, the more they're going to go in and buy a snack stick and get a glass of kombucha. And, right, it all adds to the memory. And next week, you know, six-year-old Mary's pulling on Mommy's, you know, saying, Mommy, I want to go back to that cool farm.
And at the end of the season, the pigs eat it, do they?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's all GMO-free corn. So it can be consumed by chickens or pigs or anybody. Yeah.
So going back to, the pigs and your animals on the land, how does that all work? There's a reason for not having just one enterprise and one type of animal. Let's talk about how you use it all together.
Yeah, well, certainly one of our strengths and one of our unique points is how we relate the different animals together in symbiosis. So, a couple of the critical ones are, for example, we run laying chickens in eggmobiles, we call them eggmobiles, behind the cows. The basis of this is the mimicking of the bird behind the herbivore, you know, the egret on the rhino's nose, the birds that follow the wildebeest in the Serengeti. Birds follow herbivores as a pasture sanitizer, flipping over the cowpats, eating out the fly larvae and spreading out the cowpats. So the eggmobile follows the cows. The cows move every day. The eggmobile follows, you know, about 3 or 4 days behind them. And then another thing we do is we do a lot of large-scale composting. And, of course, one reason why farmers don't like to do large-scale composting is all the materials handling. But we build these, you know, bedding piles under the cows in the winter when we feed hay. And it's anaerobic. We add corn to it. The corn ferments in there. We put pigs in. The pigs then seek the fermented corn and rotivate that, inject oxygen so it converts from anaerobic to aerobic compost. And the pigs have done all that work instead of machinery and people and petroleum and all that. So you actually get, you know, better compost because of all the multiple turning, but it hasn't taken any time with petroleum or parts or oil changes or anything like that. So it's that kind of symbiosis. You know, a final one I'll just mention, there are more, but a final one probably is like winter housing for chickens, rabbits, and pigs in tall tunnels, you know, hoop houses, big plastic hoop houses. And we put all three of them in there together, rabbits up here, and, you know, chickens on the floor and up here, and pigs on the floor. And then when they come out, they're in there for, you know, 100 days in the winter or less. And then they come out in the spring. And then we go into that bedding that's been debugged and wonderful compost, all full of worms and red wigglers and everything. And then we plant vegetables in those same hoop houses. So in the winter, it's animals. In the spring, summer, and fall, it's vegetables. And about the time the vegetables get buggy, the season's over, the animals come in, eat the bugs. And about the time the animals are getting buggy, so to speak, the animals go out and the vegetables come in. And so you're creating what I call pathogen cul-de-sacs, right? Dead ends, so that you don't get you break the proliferation of that. You know, in the typical factory farm, you know, there's no break. So there's always a host and they're always close. And so the pathogens can just gradually build. And you have to break off that host period in order to control the pathogens.
Antibiotics.
Yeah. And then you go to antibiotics. Then you're into MRSA, C. diff, antibiotic resistance, and superbugs, and another whole topic.
Can we switch to politics for a minute, Joel? We just had an election on the weekend just gone. Mm. What do you suggest people do, or how do you suggest people engage with their local, you know, politicians, councillors, you know, to actually impact or improve the food systems?
Sure. Well, you know, Australia, like the U.S., is very heavily regulated, especially in the food space. And I would just say in the agriculture space, in many ways, the agriculture land is now viewed essentially as public green space, you know, just a notch under parks. And so everybody feels like they have a say in how Farmer Jones, you know, runs his thing. And so we're seeing a tremendous increase of regulatory issues that create artificial hurdles and things for farmers to be able to value add on site, to bring people on site, to build infrastructure on site. So I encourage people to really engage with their local elected officials. I mean, I wrote a book, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. And what we have found in our, you know, confrontations or our disagreements over the years, it's really not with the elected officials, it's with underling regulatory officials. And many of them are sincere. They're trying to enforce a regulation, but many of them are very uncreative also. And so, you know, invite your politician to a barbecue if you're going to have a, you know, a get together. Attend their town meetings. Go to their barbecue, you know, and know them on a first name basis so that when you do have something you need to do, you can, you know, you can get it done. My best example was when we needed apprentice housing on our farm. And, you know, we're in an agriculture zone, so you can't even really build a doghouse hardly without a permit. So I actually went to our elected supervisor and our economic development director of our county here in Australia, via Shire. I got them out to the farm, showed them around what we were doing, and I said, I need to be able to build apprentice housing here. These guys want to be here. I need to know how to do it. I said, I don't want to look over my shoulder every day and wonder what bureaucrat's going to show up and, you know, cause me a trouble. So I want you to help me get this done. And I said, okay, give us a month. Sure enough, in a month they came back. They said, we have five options for you. Well, good. They said, we have found five things that can be built without a permit or without a zoning change. Okay. Number one, you can build a farm building. But, you know, if you build a farm building and live in it, it's hard to call it a farm building. So, you know, it's a little bit of a problem. Number two, you can build a treehouse. So, you know, Swiss Family Robinson, you can put something up in a tree. Okay. Number three is something that floats. So fortunately, we had all these ponds on the farm. So we came as close as we actually got some prices and made some rundowns on buying some houseboats that we could float in the farm ponds, because there's no regulations on boats in our county. And the fourth one is if it's on a portable chassis, like a caravan. All right. So, you know, you can put caravans and it's a chassis. And the fifth one was a hunt camp. So we have the hunt camp for the apprentices. And interestingly, the regulations don't say what you have to hunt. So we have the Polyface Hunt Camp. We're hunting for the truth.
That's great.
So the point is, the elected official worked with the regulatory official together to help us solve our problem. And I think that kind of thing, it doesn't always happen. That's a good story. All the stories aren't good. You know, they don't always end that nicely. But I could talk about the bad ones, but I want to give a good story to encourage people that if you start the conversation and they know that what you're doing is not, they knew we weren't building apartment condominiums, turning it into a city. They knew we weren't building a village. They knew we weren't building a Walmart. You know, they understood the situation. And so they, you know, looked at the system and said, here's what you can do.
Well, you were being reasonable, and I guess they did too.
Yes, yeah. And I was respecting the spot they were in, trying to keep people happy. And they respected the spot I was in, needing relief. So how can we work this out? And so coming together, both sides respectful, instead of, you know, in fists, I think facilitated a positive outcome. I wish all of them were that good. We are loggerheads on some, you know, and we haven't won all of them. But that's one we did.
You have a lot of people working on your farm and family as well.
We do, yes.
How did that all start?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, when it started, it was, mom and dad, I grew up there, and so we lived there. Mom and dad never made a living from the farm. They took their off-farm jobs, paid for the land. So when Teresa and I got married, there was open land, but no going, as we say in business, no going concern, okay? So we started a going concern, the two of us, with mom and dad's help, you know, on weekends when they were home. Then gradually they retired. So, you know, retirees can still do a lot of stuff around, drive a tractor, you know, and wash down a chicken processing shed, that sort of thing, right? Squirt a hose. I mean, you can do that from a wheelchair, right? They retired. And then fortunately, you know, I say fortunately, we started early with our kids, and they came on and grew in. And then as things developed, then we took our first apprentice, and then we took a second apprentice, and then later on we hired our first, you know, non-family member to answer the phone. She's still with us, Wendy, and she's the one that does our email, the retail store, the website, Instagram, Facebook, I mean, all the PR, social media, coordinates events. I mean, she's that gregarious people person. And so now we have, there are 20 of us that earn a full salary from the farm. And it's a combination of, you know, different kinds of things. And that includes, you know, a full-time delivery truck driver, you know, accountant. But the big breakthrough for our family was actually sitting down. And the four of us, so the four family members that are involved are Therese and I, then our son and daughter-in-law. Our daughter is not involved. She's 10 minutes away, lives in town, and runs, is the kind of the administrator of a seven counties kind of went together for kind of shared services on some things. And one is an agritourism thread. And she runs the agritourism thread of that seven county consortium. So it's kind of neat to have our daughter in the agritourism end. So the four of us, Daniel, Sherry, and Teresa and I, are the families that are drawing salaries. And so a good while ago, 10, 12 years ago, one of the best things we ever did was sit down and actually write out job descriptions, because family, it's real easy to for my universe to circle into another family member's universe. We all have ideas, right? And what happens is when our universes intersect, especially if there are employees, if there are other team members that we're in charge of, there's a lot of waste there, and you can kind of bump in. I'm being gentle here, but you know what I mean. Family business, you can get into some friction.
I work in one, Joel. It's absolutely fine.
yeah. And so your universe is bumped. So to empower all four people in very clear spheres of autonomous authority, we sat down and created written job. Here's what you are. So, you know, so Daniel, that was the official transfer of day-to-day operations to Daniel, our son. So Daniel runs the day-to-day operation. So when I go home, I work for him. And he says, here's what I need you to do, you know, tomorrow, the next day, that sort of thing. Now, it's not like I don't have any input, but he's in charge of day-to-day operations. I don't worry about it. And I love it, you know. And Teresa, my wife, is in charge of all the money. She's the most frugal of all of us. And generally, you want to put the saver in charge of the money. I mean, that's a good person to put in charge of the money. So we spend it when she says we can spend it. You know, that's good. Sherry is in charge of marketing. And my top job description is chief visionary. And that's a fun job description, chief visionary. But it actually freed all of us to be able to blossom and feel comfortable in a clearly defined role. It was very, very liberating for all of us to get that written down so we could proceed tomorrow, and we know what we can make decisions about and what we need to go to others to make decisions about, and our universes could be protected.
Joel, the buzzword at the moment is regenerative agriculture. I guess the concept has been around for many, many years, decades, really centuries, I guess. But someone who I'll have to research put that together in a nice little phrase. What's your sense of its current state in the world and in Australia specifically? Where do you think we are with that?
Well, this is where I can just be very congratulatory to Australia. I think Australians are like everybody else. No prophet is really loved in his own country or known in his own country. And so I think Australians generally don't realize how many world icons have come out of Australia. I mean, P.A. Yeomans, all right, Keyline Systems, Bill Mollison and Dave Holmgren, permaculture worldwide. I mean, what, there are now a million people who've gone through the permaculture design course, the official course. I mean, that's, I don't know of any current regenerative type movement that has that many, practitioners. And then, you know, then you move into what Peter Andrews is the guru of stream remediation. Dr. Christine Jones, perhaps the best agronomist in the world. Colin Sykes, pasture cropping, you know, he's a new one. Darren Dougherty, you know, probably the best water landscape designer in the world. So these are world famous, world traveled, best in the world. And so I think Australia can be real proud of this heritage, this legacy. And I've thought a lot about why. Why is this Australia, you know, way away from the world, this little place of 30 million people, why is it germinating all these? I might be clear off base here, but my idea is that Australia is a very, very fragile landscape, but unlike most of the other fragile landscapes in the world that are as fragile as Australia, it's wealthy. Now, the wealth is coming from mining. That's another discussion, all right? But that wealth, you know, Australia is the highest per capita income of any country in the world, number one. So that wealth has given wiggle room. It's given capital to invest, to experiment, to try things that, you know, a kid in the Sahara is just trying to figure out how he's going to eat tomorrow. You know, there's not that much wiggle room for experimentation. And so, I think that the movement, the regenerative movement, the awareness of clean food, goodness, even box schemes, the percentage of people that are on box schemes or CSAs, those kinds of things, field to fork, or chef work, you know, from South Australia to Perth to Gold Coast is I think per capita here certainly as high as any country in the world. And you can take great pride in that, and be assured that the world is looking to you. Now, it's not the majority yet. Don't sit on your heels and think, oh, we've arrived. There's plenty more to do. But I would just say, you know, you're leading, lead on, and we're watching, and thank you.
Joel, I did have to pump your tires up for a minute because, I mean, you've written a lot, many books, and you've definitely been an inspiration to me and so many other farmers. And not just farmers. I was talking to a good friend this afternoon. He's not a farmer, but he knows because he's seen you speak and he's read some of your books, he's much more connected with his food and farming and nature. So your influence has been amazing. So thank you for your for that.
Absolutely. Well, it's my pleasure. And if I stay healthy and my mind stays healthy, there's a bunch more coming. I've got a lot of titles rattling around here. I'm working on two actually right now. So yeah, I love books. Books are my medium. I mean, I grew up with books. I'm a very avid reader, and you know, I like books because you don't have to turn them on. They store really well. You never have to lose the file, you know. Now, you might have to look a little bit to find the book you're looking for, but at least you know it. I know it's here somewhere. It didn't electronically vanish. And you can write in the margins, and you can highlight and make notes. About 8 years ago, I was pretty frustrated with the predictions that, you know, books were going to be gone within, you know, 15 years or so. I don't think so. We're seeing a resurgence of books again as people have gone the electronic fad route. Okay, you know, been there, done that, and you see them come back to books. I watch the sales of my electronic versus the books, that sort of thing, and the industry, and there's definitely a flattening off of the Kindles and that sort of thing. It is definitely flattening off, if not trending down. And book sales are back up, so that's a good thing.
Going back to health, and you were talking about where Australia is at the moment, and we're leading, and we're very excited about that. Thank you. I listen to Zach Bush a lot, and he gives a lot of statistics about the rise in human disease since probably the 1950s, or when GMO really was introduced, that spike in health. All the statistics are in America.
Spike in health problems.
Health problems, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah.
All these statistics are published in America.
Yes.
Are they in a worse state than us? Why don't we have these statistics over here as much? Can we have that conversation?
Yes. Well, I think because America leads the world in industrialization, we lead the world in chemicals, in industrialization. And look, if you ask anybody on the street, what do you think of when you think American food culture? McDonald's. I mean, that's what people think. There's no other country in which anything close to that comes to the fore. And so because we lead that movement, we were the ones that developed Velveeta cheese. We developed TV dinners. We developed hydrogenated vegetable oil, you know, Twinkies. Okay. We developed that stuff. You know, and we're the first country that subsidized sugar cane, for example. So since we developed all that stuff, it's natural that we would show the symptoms of those decisions earlier than everybody else. But if you look at the trend lines in Australia, the trend lines are on the same, you're just behind. And of course, when I'm in America, I tell people, look, it's always fun to be number one. Yeah, you want the number one gymnastics team in the Olympics, right? You want the number one, whatever, swimming team in the Olympics. Okay, there are places you want to be number one. You don't want to be number one in non-infectious disease morbidity, autism, cancer, obesity, diabetes. You don't want to be number one, and we are in all of those factors, including healthcare costs, including the amount of C-sections and things like that. But yes, we're also the most infertile country. We're 30% infertile now. And I mean, the amazing thing is as that infertility trend line has gone up, just skyrocketing in the US, Africa, that backward Africa, hasn't gone up one bit. they're still as fertile as can be. Okay. And so, so it clearly is something about food. It's there's something about diet that's driving this. So I would just congratulate any other country and be thankful you're not where the U.S. is, but be careful, because I'm seeing a lot of fast food spring up around here that is of the same ilk, and it will drive that over time.
I actually think Australia is leading in the obesity stakes. I think I heard the other day, Damon Gammo might have mentioned he's got a wonderful new movie, 2040, and in conversations with him, I think we are not very proud of the fact. Mm. Yeah. So, but you're right. We're following that trend, toe to toe. And is it true to say that and Zach Bush might talk to this? That
you know Zach Bush lives about 30 miles from me.
Does he? Are you supplying him with yummy?
Yeah.
Food.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, we're negotiating. We're doing a wellness fair together at the farm this fall. We've got a date picked out, and what we want to do is invite. I mean, it's partly a marketing thing for us, but we have several health practitioners in the wellness community that are prescribing our products for their patients, and the thought occurred to me, well, goodness, you know, that's a good way to build sales. So I got a hold of Zach and his team, and we're looking at maybe just hosting a rendezvous, basically a fellowship rendezvous for all the people in the wellness community, professional wellness practitioners, all the quacks. MDs can come if they want, but it's primarily the folks who have felt disenfranchised from the health community, you know, the acupuncturists, iridologists, massage, chiropractic, naturopaths, homeopaths, right? And just come and meet each other, encourage each other, and get a farm tour, and essentially just be encouraged that there are, it's a big community, and we should know each other. Because a lot of times I know they feel isolated. They feel isolated from the wellness community.
So much respect for Zach Bush. We were really crying out for a doctor to get involved in Regenerative Ag, and a doctor that had the drive, right, to do what he's doing right now. And it's to get that message out there and bring everybody together under that health and food banner.
His work on epigenetics and the chemicals in food and how that changes gene expression, I mean, that's crazy stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's so much more. Even Joe Dispenza, if you've heard of him, you know, it's all connected. We're now bringing psychology, thought, food, all of it together, and it's so important. It's it's not just food on your plate for energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the whole thing about calories, you know, as if one calorie is the same as another calorie, and just what we're learning about the microbiome and the soil microbiome, and you know that you can cut a cross section of skin and a cross section of the soil, and they literally are mirror images of each other. Only the trained eye can tell them apart, really. I mean, they're that close. You know, we're humus, you know, and literally we are discovering these connection nuances daily. I mean, it's an exciting time to be alive. I mean, just the fact that only 10% of the soil microbes have been named. Can you imagine that? Only 10%, 90% of soil microbes have yet to be named. So, you know, I'm proposing that instead of you got these star directories where you can, you know, name a star after your lover, you know, we ought to have a soil microbe directory. You can name a soil microbe after your lover, you know.
Joel, talking about science. I like that idea, Joel. Talking about, I'm gonna go and trademark that right now.
There you go.
Talking about science, so there's been a lot of talk, especially in the States, we're hearing over here about lab meat. You know, what are your thoughts on how it does or doesn't fit into the, you know, food systems, and I guess you probably wouldn't quite call it agriculture, but in, you know, food culture.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's being driven primarily by the dysfunctionalism in the animal agriculture sector. And, you know, the problem I have is when I see things like Cowspiracy or What the Health or the UN Long Shadow Report and see, you know, the animal industry indicted for everything from desertification to climate change to whatever, I'm sitting there saying, amen, amen, amen. The problem is that all they're studying is dysfunction, not Alan Savory holistic management. They're not studying, you know, these other permaculture systems. So what we have here now is an entire a global prejudice that's been fueled by a dysfunctional model. That's the frustrating part of it, okay? The reality part of it is that, A, if there's one thing we're learning now about the soil and the human gut microbiome and all the epigenetics, all this stuff we're learning, you would think that once we start drilling into how amazingly, whatever, fluid and spontaneous biology is, that we would realize maybe we can't just duplicate meat in a lab. You would think that, but boy, it's amazing how many people want to solve technology with technology. So it's moving. One thing is that it's very, very expensive. One of the reasons there's so much venture capital pouring into it and so many big food companies buying into it, not only is it trendy, but there's a lot of money to be made. It's much more expensive to try to fabricate meat in a lab using soybeans and you know, just protein. When Food Inc. came out, I remember everybody walking around paranoid about pink slime. Remember they used that phrase in Food Inc., pink slime, pink slime. And it seems like now nobody's concerned at all about hamburger slime or, you know, fake meat slime. But one other thing I just want to point out about it is let's appreciate we can do animals that actually heal the planet and don't hurt the planet. Same animal, 180 degree different kinds of things. And we don't have time on this podcast to zero in on all that those things do, those avenues. But be assured, anybody that's listening that thinks we need to get rid of animals to save the planet, nothing could be further from the truth. The final thing I'll say about the fake meat is that it is also a psychological attempt, an emotional attempt of people who think that you can have life without death. And one of the most fundamental facts of biology is that for something to live, something has to die. I mean, a compost pile is all about microbes eating, living, being eaten, and dying, and decomposing. I mean, life, death, decomposition, regeneration, life, death, decomposition, regeneration. You know, that's a cycle that is the foundation that separates the living from the non-living. A broken bearing in your car can't decompose, be decomposed, and resurrect itself in some other car part. You know, I mean...
Not yet.
Yeah. With 3D printing and AI, who knows what might happen? Right. But you know, the difference between animate and inanimate is profound, and this cycle. And so I always tell people, look, if you don't think everything's eating and being eaten, just go lie naked in your flower bed for 3 days and see what gets eaten. You know, it's going to be eaten, and so this notion. And I think that even runs with like chemical fertilizers that we can somehow produce stuff in our fields without this biological foundation as well. We can IV it, we can short circuit it, and we can somehow put foo-foo dust on it and nothing has to die. And to me, the fact that something has to die in order for something else to live is not an emotionally depressing thought. It's an actual elevation of the psyche to appreciate life, how special it is, how sacred it is, that carrot has to give its life for me, that plant or animal has to give its life, and they're all sentient, they're all communicating. We know this now, the microbes are talking, we've isolated their language, I mean, they're talking, and so the whole cosmos is pulsing with sentience. So don't give me sentience, everything's responding. Seeds are talking, is it time to come out now? No, it's too cold, we'll stay in. Yeah, it's all sentient, all right? And so the fact is that the responsibility that we as humans have to step into that amazing cosmic circle should give us all pause to step in humbly and carefully.
Beautiful. I think I can smell dinner. So shall we wrap it up? I think it's been a great conversation.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, guys.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was wonderful.
Please follow the Biological Farming Roundtable podcast. Share it with your friends and networks. I'm Nicola Maddick and I work at Nutrasoil, a liquid biological fertilizer made from a big worm farm whose purpose is to empower farmers to produce life-enriching food.